You're listening to Veterinary Vertex, a podcast of the AVMA journals. In this episode, we chat about a novel corporate community partnership model of a domestic violence safe haven program for pets with our guest, Hillary Pierce.
Welcome to Veterinary Vertex. I'm Editor-in-Chief Lisa Fortier, and I'm joined by Associate Editor Sarah Wright. Today, we have Hillary joining us. Hillary, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to be with us here today.
Thank you so much for having me, Lisa and Sarah.
Let's learn more about how veterinarians can help the pets of domestic violence victims. Hillary, your JAVMA article discusses a novel corporate community partnership model of a domestic violence safe haven program for pets. Please share with our listeners the background on this study.
Yeah, absolutely. So to go really far back, I started a similar program to provide temporary safe foster housing to the pets of domestic violence victims when I was a vet student at Michigan State University's College of Veterinary Medicine. And it was an amazing experience. I had no idea what I was doing. I had to figure it all out from scratch. There were few, if any, resources then. And we made it work with the amazing support of the university. We had a program. Unfortunately, after I graduated and some of the other staff who were heavily invested in it moved on, the program itself didn't continue on. So when I was at Hills and wanted to look into forming a similar program, I was part of our women's employee resource group, and we started discussing this. It was really important to me and to us to make sure that the program could sustain itself beyond any individual person. So we built the program with that in mind to make sure that we had really clear protocols and procedures and roles and responsibilities in place to make sure that the program was self-sustaining and bigger than any one individual on either our side at Hills or the side of the domestic violence shelter. So we, you know, worked really hard and built the program little by little with everybody's needs and got it up and running after several years of hard work. And then, of course, wanted to evaluate how it was going, what were our learnings after the first year and a half or so, and what could we use to make the program even better. And really important to us, how could we help others who wanted to start similar programs or help domestic violence victims and their pets in their area? Because again, even though it was, gosh, you know, close to 15 years later, there still weren't that many resources out there. So that was really what inspired us to do this study and evaluate the program on top of just having it and share that information through JAVMA.
Wow, what a great program to have started and continued onward too into your professional life. So thank you so much for sharing the findings of this with JAVMA.
Yeah, of course.
And what were some of the pivotal findings from this study?
Yeah, so interestingly, partway through the development of the program as we were getting ready to launch, COVID hit, which of course nobody could see coming. And I think had we started the program during a different era, maybe our learnings would have been slightly different. Maybe not. We have no way of knowing. But we were able to determine, at least in our locale, and I think it's important to state that because we can't necessarily generalize all the findings to every region of the country or the world. But we were able to determine in our community what types of pets were the most likely to need help, what were the challenges to getting them into safe housing while their owners were seeking their own safe housing, and what were the barriers to keeping the program running, easily running, and running smoothly. And so we, you know, we were able to get the demographics of the pets and the owners who might need help. And again, that was really based in the Topeka, Kansas area. It might be different in other places. And one of the main barriers and challenges that we found was recruiting foster homes. And whether that would have been as difficult without COVID, I don't think we would be able to know. But it remains to be one of the bigger challenges that we face still.
Hillary, you talked about starting a similar program at MSU when you were a veterinary student and carrying this on to Hills. Obviously, this is a deeply embedded passion for you. What sparked this interest in establishing safe haven programs for pets?
Yeah, I was actually just trying to think of that one when I was talking about the original program. And I truly can't remember what my original kind of spark of inspiration was as a vet student. I have always been very passionate about, protecting girls and women, violence against women, making sure that the world is a safe place for everybody. And I don't think I knew what it was called then, but what we now refer to as the one welfare concept, this idea that we can't have the welfare of people without the welfare of animals and even the planet in that as well, which may not be as big of a focus for this particular project. But that's always really spoken to me, that it's not a zero-sum game. It's not either or. We don't elevate the welfare of animals and in the process make people's lives worse or vice versa. So this really stuck out to me as when I learned the facts that approximately 41% of domestic violence victims delay leaving their abuser because they don't have somewhere safe for their pet to go. That statistic really shocked me, that that's such a high number. And so that was, where I thought, well, this is an area where we can help. If they just have somewhere for their pet to go, then hopefully they can seek safe housing earlier. MSU is a really unique university in that we had a domestic violence shelter on campus as part of the university holdings. At the time, I think it may have been the only one like that. I don't know if that's changed now, but it was a big part of the university culture and community. We all knew that that was there. So it just felt like it went hand in hand for us at the vet school to partner with them and help out.
Well, it's a great story. 41% is certainly a resonating number.
I know, it's really shocking. But I think when we all think about the relationships we have with our pets, and now that we've seen things like Hurricane Katrina, which came after I set up this program at MSU, the amount of people who just will not leave their pets behind. And that's just a deal breaker for them in a variety of situations. I think we are more keyed into that concept now and accepting of it. So while it is a high number and it's shocking to hear, I don't think it's actually that surprising, because I think a lot of us would make the same decisions and if we were unfortunately in those scenarios.
Yeah, we see similar stories coming out of the Ukraine war.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You really teed up my next question well by the concept of one wellness. And this manuscript does cross many barriers. What was your decision-making process in submitting this to JAVMA?
It's a really good question, and one that I talked about with my residency mentor. So I'm a resident with the American College of Animal Welfare. And while setting up the program was not part of my residency projects, I'd actually started the program before I decided to do my residency. Writing it up and submitting it was part of that thought process. And I really just thought, where can we get the biggest reach? JAVMA is a big ring to grab for. It felt a little outside of my comfort zone, but we thought this is the place that the most veterinarians are going to see it. And my goal was for people in veterinary medicine to see this and to realize that they can and should play a role, and that there's a lot more benefit than there is risk. Whereas if we submitted it to a journal, maybe in the social work space or the psychology space, there's already a lot of conversation in those spaces around domestic violence and even the role of animals. I think that profession and community is quite keyed into this link. And it's referred to as the link in many groups, in many cases, the link between animal abuse and violence against people. But I think veterinarians can benefit from a lot more of that, and really practical tips on how can you get involved. You don't have to start a whole program in your community, but what are the things that we can do as veterinarians in the veterinary profession? So it just seemed like an obvious place to reach the most target audience that we have.
Yeah, thank you, Hillary. We have a lot of listeners who are not veterinarians as well. To those that might be interested in fostering some of these animals, how might they get involved?
Yeah, that's really great. And again, I think one thing we really learned from the setting up of this program is that it's truly a community effort. So we had the domestic violence shelter, of course, as the central component. We had us at Hills, who was able to provide resources and organization. But a program like this can't survive without volunteers. And that's not just foster homes, but people willing to transport pets back and forth. So to the vet or between foster homes. And the community members really are a key part of making something like this succeed. So I would encourage people, if they are interested in being foster volunteers or other types of volunteers for a program like this, to just do some research. Often if you Google domestic violence, pet housing, or pet foster in your community, you'll find if there is a program. If you can't find anything obvious, reaching out to the domestic violence shelters in your community, they will often know if they have a program that exists but isn't advertised or promoted, and what sorts of help they need. And they may be able to get people set up as fosters and other types of volunteers.
You're really inspiring. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
You talked earlier about some of the pivotal findings of your manuscript, but always when we write things, you're like, wow, I didn't expect that. What were some surprising findings from this study?
I think one of our biggest findings was the amount of unsterilized pets that entered the program. I don't know that that's reflective of the pet community in general. I don't think there's a higher percentage of unsterilized pets in the Topeka area than anywhere else. But it was the majority of the pets that we had referred to the program, and it made it a bit harder to find suitable foster homes for them, because people who love animals have animals for the most part. And often, you know, it's hard to match an unsterilized pet with a resident animal. So, you know, that was something I think we thought there would be some, but when it really became nearly all of them that came into the program in this period, that was a bit surprising for us. And the, I guess just the disappointment in not being able to match some of these animals for something like that, that is preventable and potentially easy to fix.
And for our listeners just joining us, we're discussing a novel corporate community partnership model of a domestic violence safe haven program for pets with our guest, Hillary. So Hillary, as you mentioned, you're currently a resident and working towards becoming a diplomat of the American College of Animal Welfare. How has your advanced training prepared you to write this manuscript?
Yeah, so I am a non-traditional resident. I am well into my veterinary career. I've been in non-clinical areas of the profession for over a decade now. And so it's been interesting to go back and take on advanced training like this farther into my career. I'm very grateful that the college allows alternative track residents and you don't have to kind of pick up and move somewhere. So learning how to do this alongside my full-time job and my life has been difficult, but I think really, really great. It's great to have a structure to have to kind of learn again in the way that we did when we were vet students and be able to study in that way. And so the training for the college really involves a lot of reading, a lot of scientific and welfare assessment. And so while I haven't had a research background in the past and not much of a publication background, a little bit here and there, it has really given me the support and the, I think, tools to be able to do something like this and connections as well. So having people in the college that I can go to ask for help with the statistics and, you know, how to do different parts of this process. Because I think when you're in research and publications are very common to your professional pathway, it becomes very easy. But when you're outside of that community, it is a bit daunting to drive a good study and publish it. So the training really helps, gives me those tools and people to help me get it there.
I think you don't realize how much of a second language scholarly publishing is until you're in it and you're talking to someone outside of it. I had that experience actually recently, and I really had to take a step back and think, all right, how can I explain this in layman's terms? Because it's just, there's a lot that goes into it, but.
Yeah. And not in this particular publication, but in a previous one I did for the residency, it can cost some money too. And if you aren't part of that university or research community, having that funding is just it's not something that individuals can do, even just to, you know, run a survey platform or something like that. It's been a learning process, but a really good one.
Now, this next set of questions is going to be really important for our listeners. What is one piece of information the veterinarian should know before discussing domestic violence safe haven programs for pets with a client?
That's a really great question. And I would say the one thing to know is that you don't necessarily have to discuss it explicitly in order to help. Knowing what the resources in your community are and having those even quietly available in your clinic can be more helpful than you could even know. Having domestic violence hotline numbers in your restroom, for example, places that clients go, that they can be private and grab that phone number in a place they might not expect it, or having the leaflets or a phone number for a domestic violence pet safe haven program in the restroom might be the only place they get a chance to find that information if their abusive partner is with them all the time, even coming with them to the veterinary appointment potentially. And so I think it can be a lot less overt and less risky and less confrontational than our colleagues might be worried about. And we can just provide that information for people to utilize. And if they ask directly, then we can have that conversation as well. But we don't have to necessarily bring it up and accuse them or their partner of being in a violent situation. So I know that's not comfortable for anybody, but just knowing the tools and providing them goes a long, long way.
And on the other side of the relationship, what's one thing clients should consider around domestic violence safe haven programs for pets?
That's a really good question too. I'd say just knowing that there are resources out there, even if they may not be actively promoted. Promoting programs takes resources. It takes people and volunteers and money and bandwidth. And so I'd say if you are in need of somewhere for your pet to go and you don't know a program by name, there's not one that's heavily advertised, give your local shelter a call if you're able to safely do so, or you know, send them an email, whatever is a safe way to communicate with them. They may have resources that they know about, but they're not kind of putting out there in terms of advertising. So just, you know, ask the question. There are websites also that try to consolidate programs available around the country. Those will be in the manuscript as well, listed a few of those as resources. But I will say they are difficult to keep updated, I think. They do their best, but there's so many small programs and so many small communities around the country that come and may go or may, again, not be promoted or heavily advertised, that they may not all be captured there. So just give your local domestic violence advocacy group or shelter a call and ask them, and they will do their best to help you.
Well, thank you again, Hillary. I'm sure you've inspired many, many people, veterinarians, clients, volunteers. So thank you again.
Oh, thank you guys so much. That's really nice. I hope that people listening are inspired to get involved, whether they are veterinarians, veterinary nurses, domestic violence advocates, and even, again, just, yeah, community members who would be happy to foster or give a pet a ride to the vet. All of that really helps, or even donating if they have a little money. These programs cost money to run as well. They need vet care, ID tags, things like that. So there's lots of ways to help.
Yeah, thank you. As we wind down, we like to ask a little more of a personal question. In all your spare time, when you start a puzzle, do you begin with the exterior, the rim, or are you an interior person?
Oh, I think like a lot of people, we did a lot of puzzles during COVID. I am a hard and fast exterior person, absolutely border all the way. I don't know why you would do it any other way. They're clear edge pieces there. They make it much easier. But my other weird puzzle quirk is that I refuse to cheat at all. So if pieces come out of the box connected, I disconnect them. So I'm starting from scratch.
That's great.
A very ethical way to do a puzzle.
That'll be my next publication, Ethical Puzzle.
Love that. I'm a border person as well, too, so I can relate. And just thank you so much, Hillary. We're really excited to get this information out there, and we appreciate you sharing this great work with JAFMA.
Thank you for the opportunity and for helping us share it.
And to our listeners, you can read Hillary's article in print JAFMA or using your favorite search engine. I'm Sarah Wright with Lisa Fortier. We want to thank each of you for joining us on this episode of the Veterinary Vertex podcast. We love sharing cutting-edge veterinary research with you, and we want to hear from you. Be sure to leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or whatever platform you listen to.